If the only creation story we had in the Bible was the one in Genesis 1, what would be missing? Welcome to Probe. We continue our series based on the book of Genesis, Beginnings and Belongings. My conversation partners are again Paul Dibdall, Larry Vavirka from the School of Theology, and I'd like to toss that question back to them. What would be missing if all we had was Genesis 1? We're focusing on Genesis 2 this week. What does that add to our story?
I think it adds a lot, actually. I still remember the first time, and I don't know exactly how old I was when I did this finally, but I started reading in Genesis 1, and of course, the first creation account there, Genesis chapter 1, with the 7 days nicely laid out, God speaking, and it was so. I was familiar with that. Chapter 2, I remember reading it, and it just struck me. I'd read it before, but it just struck me how different it was. Mm-hmm. Instead of a God who speaks from a distance and it happens, he doesn't even need to get his hands dirty. Suddenly, in chapter 2, beginning there in verse 4, you have a God who is walking around. People can hear him walking on the earth. He plants a garden. He breathes into Adam the breath of life. He, you know, the picture of God crouching over someone and forming them, the surgery that he performs to create Eve. It's just a different kind of picture of God, which is portrayed there. And it's a picture that I like very much. It's a God, a very personal God, a God who's close, a God who gets his hands dirty. That kind of personal touch, which was not as evident, or perhaps not evident hardly at all, in the first account of creation. Mm-hmm. So those are just a few of the things that we note as we come to Genesis chapter 2 and the account of creation there.
Larry, any PS on that from your part of the world?
Well, it just strikes me that in Genesis 1, the word for God is Elohim, the sort of generic word for God that was used in the Middle Eastern languages. And in chapter 2, the personal name for God is now used, the Yahweh Elohim. A name for God, on the one hand, the chapter 1 is a very transcendent picture. On chapter 2, you have a very immanent picture. Judaism, interestingly enough, reverses the use of the name for God in making it a very transcendent, you know, holy, other, unapproachable conceptualization, which had developed post-exile at the time of Jesus. It's an interesting reversal. I mean, the portrayal in Genesis is to move from the transcendent to the immanent, and then Judaism reverses that, fascinatingly enough.
Mm-hmm. I remember a conversation number of months ago by a retired pastor, very devout man, pretty conservative. He called me up and he asked me about the Hebrew word there in Genesis 2:7. Lord God formed man of the dust of the earth, and then he forms the animal later on in the chapter as well. And so I checked it out and told him. But then he paused and said, well, that's not really my question. My question is, this is such a different picture, and what he was discovering was what you just described, Paul. And how did I explain that? Well, the way I explained it, and I don't know that I've been faced with that question quite that pointedly before, is that if the first chapter meets a particular need of making sure that God is separate and distinct from his creation, and that was necessary in the ancient environment, God speaks, he does not grow out of his creation. There's always this otherness. See, if you do that job effectively, then what you end up is missing all the items that come up in Genesis 2. So to make the story complete, you really need two stories. And if you homogenize them into one, as I suppose most of us did growing up, you miss the sharp point of both of them. Mm-hmm. And I think there's great value in being able to see the sharp point in both of them. Mm-hmm. Let's go on to another aspect here, because this chapter 2 is just full of fascinating things. I'd like to talk about the business of work here, because God plants the garden. He places a human being in there. Most translations would say to till the earth. But the Hebrew word there is the same one related to servant. So you could say he placed the human being there to serve the earth. And I think that ties in an interesting way to Genesis 1, where he gave them dominion over the earth. But it's not a let's use it up, let's serve it. I'd like to toss it out and get some input from you as to how we can use Genesis 2, perhaps, to clarify our role as preservers and servants of the earth. Any comments there that might be helpful for us?
Well, I am a rabid recycler, and when I see a tree, I don't count the board feet, the dollar signs that a tree represents. A tree is a beautiful image, poetic image of praise and worship. So,
and this ties in with some of your early experiences in Yosemite, Larry.
I guess
wilderness
so.
Stuff.
These guys have never seen me show pictures or slides without Yosemite being a part of it. So, I love to be in the out of doors, of course. And if we really serve the earth, and we take seriously the mandate not to create harm, to be persons of love, that means, that extends to the whole creation, it seems to me, and that we bear the responsibility of caring well for the planet. I mean, to love others as ourselves, I think that extends beyond just life forms. Well, maybe life forms, but it extends to the whole planet as a living organism, it seems to me, and that we take that mandate most seriously.
Mm-hmm. When we go to the New Testament, sometimes devout conservatives think that, well, we're here to use this world, let's use it up. But when Jesus gives the parable of the talents, to invest our talents, and he praises them for doubling their talents, it seems to me that that entrepreneurial vision there, Matthew 25, needs to be tempered by the picture in Genesis 2, where we are created to serve the earth. Not just prepare for a future world, mm-hmm. but to take care of the one that we're in right mm-hmm. now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is it that, let me just be very blunt here, why is it that conservative Christians often miss that image and are more used to the dollar signs, we might say, to borrow Larry's image?
I don't know if it's fair to label it as a conservative issue. I would hope that wouldn't be...
You think there might be some reckless liberals as well as reckless conservatives?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
part of it, I think we might excuse it by saying that it's a sign almost of our belief that Jesus will come soon. And if Jesus' return is imminent, then we don't need to worry about, you know, long-term sustainability here on this planet. So... there's that. I think it's a kind of rationalization, which is faulty or poor at best. But I don't think it's a liberal conservative issue so much as just poor thinking.
Well, do we put it in political terms then? I mean,
expediency. I don't know what other term we might
use. Well, if you
use,
really do believe that Jesus is coming, and conservative Christians do believe that, I think the psychology that you described kicks in.
Just grab and use what you need, and because we're not going to be here for long anyway. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. All right, let's take the last question that I want us to focus on here is the relationship of male and female, because so much of our life, all of our life basically, involves negotiating that boundary between male and female and the relationships between the two. What does Genesis 2 tell us about that which would still apply in our world today? Anything there that we can say, latch onto and say, all right, This is the truth.
I like what Hazel does with this story in showing it as a Hebrew literary device, a ring construction that begins at one point and returns, brings the story to closure at the same point. Yeah, Alden, you know about these constructions better than I do, but that the picture of equality that with which the story begins, it preserves and concludes, even though the sort of disparities that are outlined as a consequence of fall stuff still brings it back to the same place again.
Okay.
I just wanted to note a couple of things. We sometimes use some real poor reasoning to try to demonstrate from Genesis 2 and 3 that somehow Adam was created superior to Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people say things like, well, Eve was created as Adam's helper. So obviously, you know, she was kind of, he could say, well, help me with this, help cook my supper or whatever. That word is a word which is elsewhere used of the Holy Spirit of God, helping humans. So it's one who helps. It's not a position of subservience necessarily, but it could be argued that it's even a position of superiority,
yeah,
that Adam would need the help of Eve. And I don't think that's the point of it, but those are some of the kinds of arguments that people will draw from the account.
Uh-huh.
Even the order of creation, well, Adam was created first, people might say. But then you have to look at the sequence of creation as a whole. Are we moving in ascending or descending order?
Uh-huh.
So again, I don't think we have here a picture. I'm not arguing that maleness or femaleness, either of them, are somehow superior one to the other, but simply that we should be careful lest we read into the story things, yeah, which are obviously not there.
It's very interesting to go back to Genesis 1 again, where it says male and female created them. The Hebrew word Adam, which normally is translated man, also is human being. The Germans have a better term, Mensch, which includes both male and female. He created them
in God's image. Both are,
yeah, yes, both are there. And I think that this then ties in with this amazing New Testament statements, especially with Paul, where he says that the woman's body belongs to her husband, and the husband's body belongs to his wife in 1 Corinthians 7. We should not overlook that New Testament passage in Ephesians 5, which is often used in connection with weddings, marriages. The verse that begins says, be subject to one another. See? And it's so tempting for those who would like to make sure that women are put in their place to start after that and say, well, you should obey your husband and so on. But those are issues which we'll begin to tackle more thoroughly, or continue to tackle more thoroughly, next week when we come to Genesis 3 and the story of the fall. Thank you, Paul and Larry, for assistance. My thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.